Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin another week. In the first hour of the show today, we have as our guest Steve Luxenberg. He is Assistant Managing Editor of Outlook at the Washington Post. Outlook is a section of the paper that runs on Sundays, and it's a collection of various kinds of pieces of opinion and commentary from various points of view. Before joining Outlook, he was the director of the Post's investigative special project staff, first as deputy assistant managing editor and later as assistant managing editor. He supervised a staff of six reporters that worked on different kinds of stories, local, national, international, financial subjects. He has been a reporter for a while before going to work at the Post. He worked at the Baltimore Sun for 11 years. He was a police and suburban reporter, then an investigative reporter, and later city editor and metropolitan editor. And during the time that he was investigative special project staff, head of that staff, he his department won a number of major awards there, including Leon Dash, who is on the faculty of the U of I now, along with photographer Lucian Perkins. They won a Pulitzer Prize for explanatory journalism in 95 for a series they did on one family's life in poverty. Yeah, Steve Luxenberg is here visiting the campus, spending some time talking with journalism students, and was good enough to come over and spend some time with us. We'll talk a little bit about investigative reporting, but I have a feeling that people who are listening also might like to talk about coverage of this year's election. He said he'd be happy to hear what you have to say about that and share what thoughts he has. All you have to do, that is, you folks who are listening, is give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can call us. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can accommodate as many different folks as possible and keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome to call. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Thanks very much.
Good morning, David.
For being here. I thought we could talk, at least for a little while, beginning here, about investigative reporting. And I thought I'd ask you to just give a definition to start out, because I suppose some people might say, well, in some sense, all reporting is investigative to one degree or another. But here we're talking about something that's a little bit different. When you use that term, investigative reporting, what do you mean?
I'm glad you said that, because I just talked to a group of journalism students this morning, and I made that point. All reporters, if they're doing their job well, are using the techniques of investigative reporting, being skeptical, pressing people, etc. I like to think that truly investigative reporters are ones who have made time their friend rather than their enemy. Time is the enemy of all daily reporters. They have to file that story by the end of the day if they're on a morning newspaper, and now with the web, they have to file it by sometimes 1 o'clock at the Post. Beat reporters are filing 5-6 inches. The investigative reporters are the ones who have been granted because of their skills and because of their inclinations a little more time, a month, several months, sometimes a year, to look at something in depth.
Because these are very time and labor intensive, investigative reporting could be an expensive proposition, and not all organizations can do it because they can't afford to have one or two people or maybe more working on a story for a long time. Those are the stories that they can't have great impact. Those are the kinds of things that can win you awards. But I suppose they also can be controversial as well, depending on what it is and the techniques that you use. What is now the state of investigative journalism?
I would be remiss if I didn't make clear that I haven't been the investigative editor of the Post for now 4 years, but I do obviously keep up with it, and I'm very interested in the state of it. I used to be the metro editor of the Baltimore Sun, and there we did not have an investigative team like we have at the Post, in part because of the kind of cost issues that you're referring to. I had a staff then of 41 reporters and a couple of columnists, and the way in which we handled investigative reporting, which is, I think, the best way to handle it in any event, because best ideas come from the reporters, is when someone would come up with something they've run across that they believe requires investigation, whether it's something traditional like a corruption allegation or something more complex like a sociological investigation, I would grant them the time to do that and then fill in behind them. And when reporters would come in and complain because Sally was off doing something for 2 or 3 months, and they had to cover for her beat, I would say our problem isn't too much investigative reporting, it's too little. By virtue of how many people we have, we really are spending about 5 to 8% of our resources on investigative reporting. I think we can afford that.
Mm-hmm. Well, how is there as much investigative reporting now as there has been in the past?
I think there's more, but I think it's of a kind that isn't as good. Everyone wants to have investigative reporting. There's a lot of what I would call tabloidization or celebritization of journalism going on. I don't want to knock poor Matt Drudge, who certainly gets enough attention, but to suggest that reporting on what other newspapers are doing, which is what Drudge often does on his Drudge Report, before they've actually reported it, you can dislike or like that, think that newsrooms ought to be as open as everyone else, but it's not investigative reporting. Investigative reporting is the kind that really unearths something original and new, or holds people's feet to the fire, that kind of thing. I thought it was interesting. The New York Times recently issued a form of an apology for their reporting on the Wen Ho Lee case. That ran in the Times. It was a sort of extraordinary statement, or was considered so in journalism. What I thought was extraordinary about it is that their reporting on that story, they at the same time that they wanted to call it investigative, they also wanted to say that it was merely reporting what the government already knew. You can't have it both ways, in a sense. There's nothing wrong with reporting what the government's already known, but that's not true investigative reporting. That's the unearthing of a prosecution that's already ongoing.
Is, when you talk about what investigative reporters do, is it the case that mostly they spend time in the library or going through public records, or perhaps now you can do that online, and it's mostly something that you either could do from your desk or basically in a seated position, not the kind of thing you're going to wear out your shoes doing?
There really are various forms, and there are still various practitioners of the art. When I began doing investigative reporting back in 1975, I would take several days to do something that I can now do at my desk. The LexisNexis service has put, for example, court records from all over the country online as part of its service. And if you can afford that service, which some newspapers, of course, can't, and some broadcasts shouldn't leave broadcast out here, I can find out facts that I could not. It would have taken me several phone calls or maybe even a trip 20 years ago. But there are we divide investigative reporting into various forms. There's the source reporting, human sources, somebody from the CIA might call it. Then there is document investigative reporting. Then there's investigative reporting that requires a great deal of complex reading and explanation. The best reporters, of course, combine all of these arts, but not every story requires you to have good, quote, human sources. Not every story requires looking at documents. One of the arts that I think is sadly lacking in journalism is many students or new reporters come to the Post, at least that's the place I know, and they really have never been to a courthouse and looked at a simple record, and they have no idea how to look it up. They're used to the LexisNexis form. Well, it's not a perfect service, and it doesn't give you everything.
Mm-hmm. There has been some controversy, I think, surrounding the business of investigative reporting in regards to the question of reporters and who they say they are and what they say they're doing, and whether or not one can, if you're doing something undercover. For example, let's just say you want to investigate some industry and you think that their behavior might be endangering the public health. And the way really to find out what they're doing is to go there and get a job. And you go and you apply for the job and you start working there, but you don't tell them that you're a reporter doing investigative work. You just go and you apply for the job. And then afterwards, the employer comes back. Now the big story is out. The employer comes back and says, well, this person lied. They misrepresented themselves. This is not – it's not legal. It's not ethical. Is it clear what you can and can't do if you're doing that kind of work?
It isn't clear, really. I have my own rules, and the Post has standards and policies, which I will briefly state. We don't ever misrepresent ourselves. We would not go undercover into a business and pretend to be an employee and then write about it, certainly not write about it without talking to the employer. There's a long tradition in journalism where that kind of approach, that muckraking, if you will, is something that is extolled. I think there is a category of consumer journalism where possibly the recreation of an experience that all consumers have could not be misrepresenting yourself. If I go into a store, I'm treated the same way as everyone else. I come out, I have an opinion about that, and then I go back as a reporter and I talk to the person about my experience. I'm not sure that that's misrepresenting yourself. The famous example of the Chicago Tribune creating a bar is one that caused a great deal of controversy in journalism. The undercover work of ABC News with the Food Lion story. I like to think of these things as last resorts. Normally, we can find out what we need to know by interviewing people who actually work in that organization, who have that experience already, and who are the real people who are experiencing that problem, if there is one. We don't need to go in and pretend to be them, unless, and I would always be flexible, and maybe there's some situation where I say to myself, you can't get that story any other way. But I've found very few times when I think that's the case.
Mm-hmm. You know, given the fact that news organizations do like to get attention, and if you're doing this in commercial broadcast television, you're concerned about ratings, that might lead you to do one story as opposed to another. There always will be stories that don't get covered either because we don't have enough time or maybe because we think that something is more important. But if you look at stories out there that you think would bear some investigative work, is there anything that you think any story that just begs to be told?
Well, I think that there's a story that we did several years ago now, 10 years ago, that I think was groundbreaking work that came back this last summer, and I thought it was very important to... I haven't done the reporting, so I don't know if it's relevant. But in the Firestone Tire Ford Explorer story, for example, I read some things that suggested to me that back 2, 3, 4 years ago, when the rollovers and tire explosions first began to come out, that there were lawsuits that had occurred that were settled out of court with protective orders. These are legal instruments that are both legal and are used to help provide documents to the other side in a lawsuit. The legal community has decided that it is doesn't want to change the private litigant way of doing the settlement of lawsuits, and so the judge becomes a referee rather than an advocate for the public. And there have been health and safety issues that have been known to small groups of people that have been hidden from the rest of us because the protective order is sealed. And I think that that's a prime area for investigation because we could prevent people from being injured or perhaps killed if some of these things would come out earlier.
I should introduce again at this point our guest. We're talking with Steve Luxenberg. He is assistant managing editor of Outlook at the Washington Post, and before that worked in the Post investigative special project staff. He directed the staff, in fact, and he's here on the campus to talk with students, journalism students, and was good enough to come over here, spend some time with us. We're talking a little bit about investigative reporting, but other subjects certainly are welcome, and at some point here I'm sure we'll be talking about the way that this election has been covered. If you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-WILL. Here's a caller, Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello?
Hi. I have a scenario that I would like to see an investigative reporter evaluate. We have a small town, and this small town has one hospital, and it's a very good hospital. Delivers good medicine, but it is defrauding its patients systematically. And one of its patients keeps records, goes into the hospital, keeps records, discovers that he's being defrauded, that is to say, overcharged, massively overcharged, and he can prove it, and he keeps the records. He takes the hospital to court. The court is horrified, sees the evidence, this is good evidence. If this plaintiff is able to win his case against the hospital, it's going to expose the hospital to class action. Everybody that the hospital has cheated, which would go back for a long way, would now have a cause of action against that hospital. So the court is afraid the hospital is going to be destroyed if the case ever comes to court, and the court dismisses the case. Now that plaintiff, having been unjustly dismissed, calls you, the investigative reporter, and he's got all this evidence. He'll lay it out before you. Are you interested?
Sure.
How are you going to do you have any responsibility for not destroying the hospital?
Well, I'm not sure that the cause would result in the effect that you're talking about.
Well, the court thought so.
Well, that's part of the, as a reporter who would be dispassionate, it would certainly be something that I would listen to, but I don't think that I would reach that conclusion without a great deal of reporting work.
Yeah.
What I would like to confirm, of course, is that there is a pattern of the kind that you describe. If this is one case and for some reason it's the only case, and I know you're suggesting that it's not, so far what you described, I couldn't prove it based upon that one patient's experience, and I would need to get other patients to show me their records as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, during the gathering of evidence, the plaintiff's gathering of evidence, he has talked with department heads of the hospital, and they have admitted to him that part of his bill went to, as they say, finance charity patients. That's what they said. But then, when he looked at the hospital's financial reports, he found out that only 2.3% of the hospital's income was expended on charity patients. Evidently, there was much more income, excessive income, than 2.3%. In other words, it looks as if there's been some embezzlement. And since we have statements by the department heads, that looks as if the abuse is systematic and it's been ongoing.
Well, it seems to me that there are many parties here that would have an interest in preventing embezzlement or fraud at any institution. I'm not sure, because I'm not a resident of the state of Illinois, of how hospitals are regulated. I know a little bit about the state of Maryland, where I live. They have a hospital cost review commission. But I could imagine that the reporter could get a great deal of help in figuring out the system, whether the embezzlement is going on, what are the rules and regulations regarding the diversion of monies to that portion of the population the indigent population that cannot afford things. And I think that it's in the hospital's interest to prevent embezzlement, unless, of course, it's being done at the top levels. I don't think it would destroy it. It would probably save it.
Well, that's basically the question that I'd like you to ask. How would you approach a situation like this so as to correct the corruption, correct the abuse, without destroying the hospital?
Well, as I say, you can raise questions about what's happening at an institution without reaching the conclusion that the embezzlement... It's pretty hard for someone without subpoena powers to prove embezzlement. But you can raise questions that would draw other authorities' attention to that problem. If a prosecutor or a regulator were to find out that there was embezzlement or fraud going on at a particular institution, they would not stop and say, well, am I going to destroy this hospital? That may have been that judge's opinion. I haven't seen the records in that case. But it would not be the opinion of a law enforcement person. So I would, as I say, I would do a systematic approach in which I would talk to a lot of patients. I would try to interview people at the hospital. They might be opposed to talking to a reporter, but you never know. I've been in lots of situations where you would have thought that, and it wasn't the case. And I would then talk to regulators. I would talk to law enforcement people. But I would be very – I wouldn't worry so much about destroying the hospital. I would just be worried that I was being – I wouldn't reach a conclusion. I wouldn't adopt the conclusion that the patient has reached. As a reporter, I would be dispassionate, and I would not convey to the authorities that I would – my own conclusions about what the hospital was doing without any evidence.
Well, it's so interesting to talk to you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We are getting close to our midpoint here. Again, our guest is Steve Luxenberg. He works at the Washington Post, where he is now assistant managing editor of Outlook. That's a Sunday section of analysis and commentary. Before going to work at Outlook, he directed the Post investigative and special project staff. And we have been talking a little bit here about investigative reporting. We'll probably get on to some other subjects. You can give us a call if you have a question, comment, 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. One of the things we know is that many Americans, they don't hold reporters in the news media in particularly high esteem. Has that made it more difficult for journalists who are trying to hold on to what I think a lot of reporters have seen as the traditional role of the media, and that is looking out for the welfare of the public. That's, I think, at the bottom, that's real, the bottom line, that's what investigative journalism is really about. Is it more difficult now?
I think that it is more difficult. It's certainly more challenging because with the advent of investigative reporting 25 years ago and the flood of that kind of reporting, and it goes in cycles. Sometimes we have a lot of it. Sometimes we don't have very much. But there are more and more outlets that try to practice investigative reporting. I feel that the public has become somewhat inured to investigative reporting. You almost can't get their attention. Oh, another scandal. And they expect a newspaper in some areas. I would never say that investigative reporting or scandal mongering is true in every community in this country. It certainly is not. But when the public sees it, especially in the national media, on television, you now have news magazines on television, several versions of Dateline, two versions of 60 Minutes, 2020, et cetera. And while they do various kinds of stories, there's always a kind of investigative report that's part of their hour. I fear that the public is yawning, that we've made them, as I say, inured to this. When you go out in the public, I'm always amazed at how, despite the polls, which I think are accurate, that say that the press is not highly regarded, Americans are pretty helpful. Part of it's human nature. They're flattered to be asked. And if they know something or they feel that something's unfair, they like talking to the reporters about them, which is great for reporting. But I think that we've become more sophisticated, at least some, I think some news outlets have become more sophisticated, about finding the story beyond just the obvious so-and-so took a trip he shouldn't have taken, or she you know, paid herself too much money or hired somebody that he or she shouldn't have hired. And trying to understand the motivations of people who would might commit a wrong, to do something wrong, as opposed to just the gotcha part of it. And I think that's important. I think people want to know, well, why would the person do that?
We're, at, as I said, about at our here, about at our midpoint. And as I mentioned a moment ago, our guest, Stephen Luxenberg, works for the Washington Post. He's here visiting the campus. And we'd be very happy to have questions, comments. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Well, I thought we'd maybe shift gears a little bit here and talk about the coverage of the campaign this year. I think that you know, we still get the same criticism that we've gotten in the past, that is that reporters, news organizations are spending too much time on the horse race aspects. And what the polls say, of course, what they say this year is pretty confusing. They don't really tell us much of anything. And not enough time looking very closely at what candidates have to say, the programs that they advocate, trying to answer the question, is that right? Do they have the details right? Is it likely that things will work out the way that they say that they will work out? How do you think that news media is doing, in a sense, at both of those things? Because that's, you got to cover both parts of those stories. You don't want to just do maybe one or the other. But do we spend enough time? Is there enough enough airtime and enough ink devoted to digging into what candidates say, what they have done in the past, and what they say that they will do?
I think George Bush might feel we do a little too much time digging into the past, as of what happened on Thursday with the revelation of a 24-year-old incident of driving under the influence. And that would be an interesting question as to whether that was a fair story to have at this point in the campaign. It's hard to talk about the press as a monolith in this particular case. It always is. I would say that there are as much variations on this theme as there are any standards. The Washington Post, the New York Times, the other national media, I think if you did a content analysis of how much ink they are spending on the issues, you would be surprised at how high the percentage is. They also are engaged in daily polling, something that didn't happen 25 years ago. It's expensive. We obviously think that the public wants to read about it, hear about it. The Post is on its website doing a daily tracking poll. It's a very tricky instrument to do well because you're doing polling constantly. Are people home? Who's home? What parties are they from? How do you get the right sample? You don't have much time. How accurate are they? And that's your reference to the fact that the polls have been confusing is exactly right. They're contradictory because I think the quality, it'd be interesting to go back and see the quality of the polling that's been done. Do we spend enough time on the issues? I think that because of the advent of the debates, where you get 90 minutes in a sense of issues, there's a lot of personality and character that's coming out in those 90 minutes, but in essence, they talk about substance. I think I see a retreat in letting the debates become the mechanism by which we learn substance. It is widely broadcast. If you don't want to watch it on ABC or NBC or CBS, you can watch it on cable, you can watch it on C-SPAN. There's no limit of the access you can have to the process at this point. I think it's quite a confusing time for journalism. The web and cable has dramatically changed the nature of journalism. There's more of a cacophony of voices out there, a noise level that I don't know that people are turned off to it, but I could imagine that they would argue they can't get away from it, and that what happened to the good old days when you could just listen to one show, Walter Cronkite, you know, my childhood, Walter saying goodnight, this is CBS News, is long gone. So I think that if you want to read about the issues and you care, you can go on the web and find out their positions at their own websites. There's no limit of information out there.
Let's talk about this George Bush story that you mentioned. This fact that some 20 some years ago he was arrested DUI. I think this is precisely the kind of thing that people will point to when they say, you know, this is what we don't like about reporting. It's now scandal mongering. Something that's this old, what does this tell us at this point? And also they will question the timing of the announcement and just who's, you know, who benefits by the fact that the story comes out at the point that it does. Should this story have been reported at all? Or how do we even think about whether it's appropriate to go with a story like that?
Let me be clear that my information on here is no better than yours and your listening public's. I read things. I'm not involved in this coverage. I was fascinated to read that a reporter for a Maine newspaper who had learned of this several months ago in the course of his court reporting, because there were court records in Cunningbunkport, had decided on his own that it wasn't even worth telling his editors about, according to the story that I read. And he defended his decision and thought that it was just not relevant. It was too old. And in every campaign, it's always good to go to the videotape, as sportscasters like to say. There comes a story about whether it's too old. Bob Dole, there was a story about a relationship and whether that was too old. And so we wrestle with this, and we I'm now using the imperial we to imply the news media. In this case, I think it was probably somewhat easier for the television reporter who heard about this in the courthouse, who pursued it and unearthed it and thought it was news on Thursday last week, to report it or to convince her editors and her producers to report it, because it fit the storyline that we already knew. George Bush has admitted that he had a drinking problem when he was a younger man. This fit into that. Is there any big surprise here? When I first heard about it, I said, this isn't going to change anything because there's nothing surprising here. On the other hand, he did have to recover from it for 2 days. And I can talk about this as a journalist and talk about it as a strategist. Mm-hmm. You suggested, David, that perhaps it would help him in a way. The media would be the target and not the politician. And therefore, it might bring out Republican faithful to vote for him, saying, I'm not going to let this unfairness stand. These things are not easy to decide, and I'm glad I didn't have to make the decision. I think that some of the Republican Party strategists that I talked to last week were frustrated with George Bush's campaign for not somehow finding a way to bring this out 2 years ago.
We have a couple of callers. We have several callers. Let's talk with some more
folks.
We moved
from journalism to politics, and we got the callers.
There you get the callers. In Urbana, we'll start here. In line number one, in Urbana. Hello?
Yeah, just a short question. I was just wondering how, if you happen to know anything about what happened this weekend as far as this story that's going on between the Boston Globe and, I understand, the London Times, where someone claims to have personal firsthand knowledge of people coming in and trying to clean up Bush's military record by, you know, expunging anything that points to his AWOL period. How did the people at Washington Post approach that? Did they call up the Boston Globe and the London Times? Did they try to follow up on it? Or are they doing so today? How did they decide not to cover it if they didn't, etc.?
You've caught me unawares. I really don't know what the Post has done with that, and so I can't give you any information or illuminate anything. I suspect that, knowing our pattern, we will have tried to report it to learn about it and then decide whether there's anything worth publishing. But I actually don't know any details. I apologize.
Would that include for the first step be calling the reporters involved in the other newspapers?
Generally not, but we would certainly read whatever the other newspapers would have reported and talk to. We would do sort of two lines of inquiry. I'm talking about hypothetically. We would begin to talk to the people in the campaign to find out whether there's any underlying truth to the substance of what you were just talking about. And then we might also call. It wouldn't be unheard of to call a reporter, but usually we try to regard reporters as dispassionate observers and not the sources of information. But it depends. I know that in a previous campaign, and I'll just say this very briefly, involving a United States senator, that we concluded that we should not publish anything after Saturday before the Tuesday voting day because we felt that there was not enough time for the candidate to recover. We eventually did publish a story after he was reelected, and we got criticized for not publishing what we knew, and I felt we didn't know enough before the election ended. So it is a controversial thing to these last few days. There was kind of a time-honored policy years ago that Sunday was kind of it. You just didn't write anything on Sunday, Monday, that the candidate couldn't recover from. I'm not sure that obtains in the age of the web.
Yeah, I was going to say that seems like a arbitrary approach to this, given that there's such a frenzy going on. But thanks.
All right, let's go to another Urbana person here. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Harking back to the call before last about the drunken driving, it seems to me you're probably right that a 20-year-old drunken driving conviction is probably not newsworthy at this point. However, George Bush denied this 2 years ago, and I wonder if that isn't of some importance, given that one of his basic premises has been that he is truthful, would never lie, and that his opponent, in fact, he's gone to the point of misquoting Vice President Gore on the web invention. It's been a primary campaign motif for Bush. And I think it's been demonstrated that it is a misquotation that he has been showing as a primary characteristic of Gore. Given this, I wonder if his cover-up doesn't become newsworthy.
I think I wouldn't want to share your view that it's a cover-up because I'm not sure of the facts myself. I can tell you a little bit.
Assuming
it is. This is why people argue that this kind of reporting ought to be done, ought to be published, and to allow the candidate to react. It was the revelation that George Bush in 1996, I believe, had denied to a Dallas Morning News reporter that he had been arrested after 1968 being an incident at Yale where some sort of prank where he was arrested as a young man, and that therefore it was, in fact, telling, given his assertions about Gore's character and the relationship to the Clinton administration and the scandals there. This is why we have campaigns and why people can assess this for themselves, and I don't have much of a problem in this case with that, unless, of course, it were leaked at the last minute and held back. Excuse me, it would be troubling if it was held back in part to try to do an October, or in this case, November surprise. The facts of what happened in that interview with the Dallas Morning News are not terribly well known. There are some people who believe that the governor's aides hustled the reporter out of the room at the last minute and that he really never answered the question all that specifically. But he certainly didn't unearth it. And as a voter, or as voters out there, they have a right to decide that maybe George Bush was withholding something. I suspect, just looking at it as a strategist, that the issue of whether George Bush is honest is really not the primary issue that people have with him. He's pretty direct and straightforward about his opinions and his views, his ideology. And I don't think that that's really that. I wonder whether one incident of, understandably, and I'm not trying to be sympathetic to George Bush or to Al Gore here. I try to be dispassionate. But that the holding back of that incident is sort of human nature. I just don't know how it plays out there. We'll see.
Well, I would agree with you that it's human nature. And actually, I guess that could have been said about President Clinton's holding back. It's just that it's being accepted as human nature on the one side, and the other side is crucified for it.
Right. We're not very forgiving in the media about these kinds of things, are we? I mean, we want to crucify everybody.
It seems sometimes that one side is quite forgiven. But
I hear you.
Maybe that's my opinion. But anyway, thank you for the critique.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, let me ask you this. I think that criticism has been made of the media. Media has been criticized for being more critical of or looking more closely at things that Mr. Gore has said and pointing out misstatements than things that Mr. Bush has said. I think, though, in fairness, probably each side has made that charge. I'm sure that the Democrats have said, the media aren't being hard enough on Bush, and the Republicans have said, media aren't being hard enough on Gore. As you look on it, do you think that that either side has a claim to make that somehow there's been more scrutiny of their candidate than the other guy?
I actually don't think that either side has much to say about that, because I think there are failings on both sides when it comes to the way the media has gone after the story. I would argue that certain storylines develop, and that when the facts fall outside of those storylines, they aren't pursued very ardently. So, for example, Al Gore is an exaggerator, would be the assertion. I won't use the word liar, but others might. George Bush is dumb. I'm not saying he is dumb. I'm saying that's the assertion, the impression. So when George Bush is unable to articulately explain his Social Security plan, it's attributed to his lack of intelligence by some people. Other people have analyzed the plan and say, he's not telling us the truth about this plan. So why don't we look at his truth? The Wall Street Journal, on an opinion piece by their Washington bureau chief, had a headline, "The Real Whopper, George Bush's Social Security Plan." That headline was to convey, why aren't we be talking about the real untruth here? Meanwhile, on the Gore side, every time Al Gore slightly boosts himself, as candidates do, it becomes fodder for the idea that he's an exaggerator, to the point where, as a viewer watching those debates, I thought in the second, third debate that Al Gore didn't quite know who to be because he was afraid of making a statement that was going to be picked apart, as legitimately his statements were picked apart in the first. So it's a very tough situation to be, and I suspect that you could pick apart my statements right now.
Given we talked about the fact that the polls have been confusing and that when you consider the margin of error, it's been a toss-up, and it's been a toss-up for some time. One thing, though, that also seems to have been fairly consistent is that we know that there's a significant number of voters that say they don't know who they're going to vote for. And then for those who say they're likely to vote for one or the other candidate, also a significant number of them say they might change their mind. When it comes down to it, and people go into the booth to cast their vote, what do you think? What will this election turn on? What are people going to grab onto to try to make the choice?
Well, the modelers would say that what they will grab onto is prosperity, and that they'll stay with Gore. This is several of the economic political models that have been done by academics. But I think that the economic prosperity has been around for so long that it may be that we take it for granted. It extends back into the Reagan years. Mm-hmm. Who do we attribute it to? Are you better off now than 4 years ago or 15 years ago? I think that it's clear, at least there was an article in our section that was, we ran a series of four articles from swing states. Illinois was not one we chose, but from Michigan, Ohio, Florida, Washington State. And the man who wrote the article from Michigan had an amazing fact, I thought. On the issues, Gore, the voters were asked about how they felt about the positions on issues in education and healthcare. And in both cases, Gore outpolled Bush by 50 plus to 30 something. But it was a dead heat. What does that tell you? It tells you that Gore is not very likable. That Bush is more likable. But people don't really want to go into the voting booth and vote on likability, I don't think, or as Walt Whitman said in the 1890s, likability. He made up a lot of words about politicians. And I think that they want to hold on to something more substantial than that. I think they know the issues. I think they know about Social Security. I think they know about the tax cut plans. I think they know about foreign policy. And I think that the reason the election is close is because neither candidate has emerged as one that really grabs people's imagination.
We have about 5-6 minutes left. Our guest is Steve Luxenberg. He's assistant managing editor of Outlook at the Washington Post. Outlook is a Sunday section of analysis and commentary. And before that, as we mentioned near the beginning of the program, he was the director of the Post Investigative Project staff. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And let's see, where we'll go next, Bloomington. I presume this is Bloomington, Illinois, line number 4.
Yes, it is Bloomington, Illinois, David.
Yes, well, go ahead.
Your first caller was from Bloomington, Indiana.
Yes, and I would never confuse the two of you.
Yeah, I'm sure you wouldn't. You were speaking about George Bush's conviction for DUI 24 years ago, and you seem to be feeling that he should be absolved from that because it was so long ago. Now, I want to point out something. He has been proclaiming himself as the one who will bring dignity to the White House. And I also want to point out that he was a heavy drinker, apparently, from what the news reports, for at least 10 years after that drunk driving. Now, are you trying to tell me that during all that period of time that he was still drinking, that he did not drive under the influence? He wasn't caught, apparently, but are you trying to tell me that he would have been not driving during that 10-year period?
Not at all, sir. I think it's important, his past behavior on drinking, and that's what I was trying to point out was that his drinking and his addiction to alcohol was known before this incident was revealed last Thursday. And I had assumed that he had perhaps been drinking and driving, and I thought everyone else had. But if you think that it's an important point to bring out, I don't absolve him of anything. I'm not an
I didn't say you, sir. I was talking to David.
Anyway, I think that it's an important point to bring out, and it's clear that it's something that troubles you as a voter, if I'm picking up what you're saying.
Oh, and I guess I would say if you heard me absolving George Bush, I would now state categorically that I'm not an absolution business, so I was not meaning to make a statement either for or against Mr. Bush.
But still, I want to reemphasize what I said at first. He has been claiming that he is the one who will bring dignity back to the White House. Do you call that bringing dignity back to the White House? If you do, I don't.
No, I think what we were saying is that because it happened on Thursday, it was a different issue, a journalistic issue that came up. But clearly, I would suspect that you felt, because of his drinking problem, that he would not bring dignity back to the White House before last Thursday. Is that true?
Well, no, the caller's gone. And in fact, we're almost at the point where we're going to have to quit anyway. I'm going to get real quick here, Champaign County, and then we're going to have to go to line number two. Hello?
Yeah, there's no time to deal with this, really, but I wanted to ask about unacknowledged sources, or what is the key word for that? I mean, I saw this thing on Lori Berenson, Investigative Dateline or Primetime, I forget which one it was, but the very end of the thing was, we have from an unidentified source that she indeed was acting undercover for a guy that was killed in the Peruvian embassy, and it was just introduced, without any explanation about why he would not identify himself. They didn't even say national security reasons. They just outline that. But I also know that the Times has somebody on other things about Bush, and they have an unacknowledged source that he was dealing coke as well as using coke, and this is a plausible thing in that he was running failing oil businesses while he had a big habit, and it's a plausible thing. It's also more plausible that a fellow Yalie who has gone off the record to say that this has been the case would not want to acknowledge that. You can find that at counterpunch.org along with a lot of other investigative journalism.
Well, quickly, I think that unacknowledged sources or informed sources, there are various forms of this word, this phrase, are the trickiest thing in journalism, because we know that you as a reader or a viewer don't trust sources that you can't identify. Sometimes, as you pointed out, national security, you can't always identify your sources. But I am a big critic of journalism for this. I think that we abuse this, and I think that often we can get people on the record, is what we call it, and we don't try hard enough. There are many kinds of stories that if you just worked harder at it and you didn't give the person the opportunity to go off the record, they wouldn't go off the record.
We're going to have to stop here because we're at the end of the time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, I'll just mention that our guest, Steve Luxenberg, is going to be talking about investigative journalism at a brown bag at noon today in 123 Gregg Hall. And I'm sure that anybody who's interested in dropping by and hearing what he had to say should feel themselves welcome. And we want to say also thanks very much.
Thanks, David,
for being here. Steve Luxenberg, Assistant Managing Editor of Outlook at The Washington Post.